Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher. I am the senior NBA reporter at Yahoo Sports, and I'm joined by my man, your man, everyone's man, senior NBA writer at Yahoo Sports, Dan Devine. What's up?
Not much, Jake. We are getting down to the nitty gritty of the NBA season. And I don't know about you, but I'm pretty excited that we're not going to have any more like 13 game nights anymore pretty soon.
The other thing, too, I went to Clippers Bulls as we're recording this. I'm recording this from our Yahoo LA offices on
Hard
Monday.
Hard traveling hero out here, crisscrossing the country in search of adventure.
In search of a Wi-Fi connection enough to be able to do my job. Honestly, that's really it. But quick tangent. It feels like these last 5 to 10 games for everyone, they're just more at stake this season. We'll get into it later in our play and push segment, TM play and push. But I'm sure for someone like yourself who's just downloading League Pass into their eyeballs at all times, this has been, I mean, people at the league level, on coaching staffs, on front offices, players, they're feeling it. I'm sure a lot of our listeners, just like yourself, are feeling it too.
Well, yeah, the fact that there's so much still to play for, that there's so many teams that are still alive in some capacity or not, you know, that, and even the ones that are sort of falling away, a couple of them are playing for ping pong balls, trying to get into that fifth or sixth lottery spot in the near 10% shot that gives you at the number one pick. Like, all of these games have stakes. Most of them have like positive affirmative stakes that you're moving towards something good. And some of them have negative ones, like we're, you know, getting to the back of the bus. But yeah, there's a ton to play for. There's a ton to keep an eye on. And there's, for one team in particular here, we're going to be traveling to an area they have not been to in a very long time. And there's an awful lot of excitement surrounding that.
Yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get right into the news where the Sacramento Kings, Kings City, Cowbell Kingdom, Northern California's finest. They have clinched their first playoff berth since 2006, and the beam has been lit. People are lit. Sacktown lit. I mean, it's the longest playoff drought in NBA history that is now up in smoke. That record, maybe it'll live in infamy like on the opposite side of a Wilt Chamberlain 100-point, you know, immortal record, because I think it'd be very challenging for a team to find a way to not make the playoffs for the better parts of two decades ever again.
Yeah, now that like 96% of the league makes the playoffs, yeah, it's going to be tricky.
Yeah, so that one I think might, you know, hang a banner in the rafters maybe in like the just hall of obscurity in NBA history. But like, I don't know. Am I wrong to believe? I mean, I've been on the Kings bandwagon from the Domas Tyrese Haliburton trade that's been relitigated to death, and Tyrese Haliburton talks about it in every single interview that he does. but I mean, I flew out there in November and got a feel for just what was brewing. And I mean, I talked to Kevin Herter last week when the Kings came through New York. Like, I feel confident in this, you know, historic offense they've got. What's your take here, Dan? What's your feel on the, you know, the feel good Sacramento Kings?
Well, my first feeling is feeling old, right? Because in seeing the Kings clinch their playoff spot with, I think it was 120-80, like an absolute blowout win over the Blazers in Portland, a Blazers team that is going the other direction.
Yeah.
And that the enormity of that number, you know, it's 2006. That is, you know, it was 16 years. This is their 17th year since they last made the playoffs. I was 23 years old the last time the Sacramento Kings made the playoffs. I had just gotten my first job at a media thing. I was working at a community newspaper in Boston, and I looked it up. The day before the Kings' most recent playoff game, the first story I ever wrote that ever got published anywhere went up. The Thursday edition of that weekly newspaper. So it is wild to think about, like, a literal, like, my entire career, basically. I didn't even know the basketball blogging was a thing. It might not really even have been a thing in 2006. The entire career that I now have has happened in the space between when they last made it and when they are going to play next. And it led me to a big question. May 2006, what is Jake Fisher doing? How old is Jake Fisher, May 2006? And what is Jake Fisher doing, May 2006?
I just want to point out that now you're flipping the script on me. Instead of me making fun of you for being old, you're making fun of me.
Oh, yeah.
For being an
That's why I love this.
Yeah.
I'm very excited
to be clear. I want our listeners to know that you can bully me just like you have accused me of bullying yourself.
That's exactly right. So now spill it. Where were you May 2006?
I'll tell you. So May 2006, I was 12 years old.
Oh.
And I'll tell you this. I was writing. I was a sports columnist at the Raptors Roar at Rosa International Middle School in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I had a column called What's Up With Sports? And I would ask a question.
What a great name for a column.
I mean, I was on the grind. This is what I wanted to do from a young age, man. And I remember we had a tour of the middle school, like, the day before school started. You could go because, you know, little 11, 12-year-olds, people were, you know, afraid, I guess my mom was, that we weren't going to be able to find our classes because
sure.
For us, that was like the first time you didn't just like go to one classroom all day.
Right.
And I remember we sought out Miss Halden, Lillian Halden, who I'm still Facebook friends with. We sought her out because I told her I was going to be a sports columnist at the middle school paper, and it started this journey, man. So while you were getting your community reps, I was as well. So take that. Take that. You thought you had me.
No, I mean, honestly, it's more I had myself, because as soon as you said you were 12 years old, I wanted to crawl up into a small ball and die. But I mean, grim death not far off for me. We can fairly say that. But it does sort of cast into relief just how long a time it's been. And part of the process here where we've been looking at what happened since then. And there's a lot of those sorts of stories. You know, the iPhone wasn't invented yet. This was the number one song in America, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
Like, the amount of turmoil and upheaval and just sort of stress and drama that's been, that franchise has gone through, you forget, it's a little bit easy to forget now because we are, you know, a handful of years removed from it. This was like an existential crisis in Sacramento. That team was gone. It was sold to Steve Ballmer's group. The idea was to move it to Seattle.
It was
gone.
It was going to Seattle.
And then the subsequent, you know, the machinations from there, and the art, you know, David Stern fighting with it to keep the team in town, finding local buyers, the Maloof family continuing to say no. The idea of, like, are they going to play in Anaheim? Are they going to play in Virginia Beach? Where are they going to go? And this fan base, this community that dug in so hard to try to keep that team there, even as that team was awful and would be awful for the next few years, to see that faith rewarded in this way with this team, which, as you said, like, is so joyous to watch. That offense is incredible. There's so much fun to watch and to follow. It's just really, really rad to see how far they've come from those really, like, the lowest moments over this past 16-year drought.
Here's the thing, though. This is the last Kings question I had for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious. You're obviously not an NBA coach, no offense, but I want to understand your...
I have the sleep deprivation of one sometimes, but that's about
there
it.
There you go. I want to understand your perspective on Sacramento in the postseason, because that's what matters now. They've got here. We're going to celebrate. It's great. We have celebrated. But, like, there's no one in the NBA who takes them seriously. And, I mean, I'm talking opposing coaches, opposing front office. I mean, I got drinks with someone here in L.A. last night who was kind of like, come on. Like, the Kings? Wait, come on. The Kings? Everyone understands the offense. They think it's beautiful and fun to watch. They're very skeptical of the defense and their ability to actually get stops when it matters. I mean, that's the King. I mean, I know that's the Kings' self-reflection as well. Like, they have fully embraced the fact that we're going to be able to outscore anyone. We need to get a couple of stops when it matters. They've got a lot of practice of it in all these close games. I remember when they came through to Brooklyn, whenever it was, a week and a half ago, I was talking to some people on the team, and, like, they do kind of believe, at least they're hoping that, I mean, I don't know the numbers in front of me, but it just, anecdotally speaking, seems like they're always playing crunch time, you know, games within 5 points within the last 5 minutes on the road environment type stuff. Their Kevin Huerter, Domantas Sabonis dribble handoff action was, like, kind of the big central piece of my story with Kevin Huerter, because to me it's been my favorite little pet action around the league. Both those guys at that, like, it's not a traditional, you know, spread pick and roll that's kind of, you know, canvassed the league right now. And it's, and particularly with Huerter, it's interesting to me because it's in direct contrast to what Atlanta's running, where Trae Young just pounds the ball primarily. That's an action that I 100% know opposing coaches are looking at, and they're figuring out ways to kind of stamp it out. What kind of, I mean, just counter punches are you prepared to see Sacramento do here? Or do you also think that at a certain point in time, things are just really going to come down to De'Aaron Fox being able, I mean, I know you're kind of into his ability to hit the brakes, and he seems like he's been one of your most favorite players to watch, just as I have followed your tweets more and more over the last several months.
Oh, God help you.
Yeah, just try to get inside the psyche of your Twitter fingers and what's happening over there.
I think there will definitely be a time where the offense bogs down and it's up to Fox to win one-on-one. That's what we have seen from them so much this season. You mentioned all the clutch games. They've 42 of their games, so more than half their games this season, have been within 5 points in the final 5 minutes. That's tied for the seventh most in the league. The Heat are number one because the Heat cannot. They're, like, contractually obligated to only play in close games because they can't score and no one can score on them when it matters. The issue with, and Fox has been brilliant at that all season long, leading clutch scorer in the league, I believe leading fourth quarter scorer overall in the league, consistently getting great shots on balance, able to wrong foot defenders with that stop and pop game that you mentioned. The issue is going to be what happens when there's more size on him more consistently. They had trouble against Minnesota the other night. Jaden McDaniels, huge, long defender. Also, Anthony Edwards, a guy that they could throw on him. So it's going to depend on matchups and what a team's going to be able to do. He's still going to be able to get his against most defenders, but that it makes everything harder. And if you already are already gumming up the works of what the offense is and slowing it down into one-on-one play, bigger defender on shorter guard is a matchup you got to like if you're the defense. The big thing that you point to, though, those dribble handoffs, and they run that more than anybody in the league by a long shot. And the reason it's been so effective is because you've got, like, four guys or five guys you feel pretty comfortable doing it, right? It's Huerter has been, like, the revelation in it, but Fox can do that coming off the ball. Keegan Murray has been, like, went from not doing that at all in college to being really good at it.
He snipes off those, man. He comes off looking to fire.
And he's a legit 40% three-point shooter right out of the box, right? Harrison Barnes, the guy who can run that. You know, Malik Monk coming off the bench, guy who can run that. They have a bunch of Davion Mitchell. Another one is not the shooting threat off the catch there, but there's just so many guys you can run that with that I think there might be an opportunity to kind of mismatch hunt in a different way. If you got a defender that you're trying to, like, park on somebody away from the ball because you don't like the way that they navigate screens, you don't like the way that they move off the ball, bring that guy up to Sabonis and let Sabonis plant him and give his guy a running start to curl off the catch, off the handoff, or pull up and fire. And I think there's sort of the fluidity of that, the way that they understand how to cut back door off of it. Sabonis as a decision maker from the high post. There's willing passers sort of all over the place. So I think that gives you a lot of opportunities to work your way through an offense, through a defensive possession. the concern is if you meet like a really great defense that is locked in on shutting off those handoffs, not allow, you know, ball denial, not allowing a guy to get clean into the catch, then that can really stop up the machine. But it's really hard to do that. It's hard to do that 90 possessions a game. It's hard to do that when you've got so many live targets. I think that offense is going to translate. So the question, as you said, is can they get can they string together enough stops when it matters to hold up? Home court advantage is going to be big because I think that city's going to go absolutely nuts for a playoff game.
Cowbells are coming, man. Cowbells are coming.
Like, for it to have been as loud as it's been during the regular season, you know, the sort of euphoria that's going to be a playoff atmosphere there, I think is going to be awfully tough to play in. And there are experienced teams and there's, you know, guys that are not going to be fazed by that. But it's just really hard to execute when your brain's rattling like that. So I get why. In the context of a Western Conference where so many other teams have so much more experience and so much more of a track record of success in the playoffs, people are salivating at playing the Kings. I just think it might wind up being one of those be careful what you wish for type situations.
The most important piece of reporting I did from Sacramento in November, and we've talked a long time about the Kings, but we're going to get, I mean,
they're the biggest story in the sport today, right now. That is totally fine.
The three
when has that ever been true over the course of the last 16 years? Sacramento gets its word in today.
And our next little news item was to talk about Kevin Durant's return. Like, they're so far up on Phoenix that it's not just that they've clinched, that they're legitimately getting home court advantage and teams are clawing their way out of seven to get to the sixth seed to try to just get this matchup that they're going to, I mean, they're in a good position, but
they're only
two
back of Memphis in second, by the way, only two games. Like, it's unlikely that they're going to get up there, but it's not impossible at this stage.
So the most important reporting for my Sacramento trip, because we have to report for the people. I asked.
You are the people's insider. I'm going to make sure that everybody understands that.
There we go. I asked back in the day when the first cowbell was brought to, I believe it was Arco Arena at the time, following that Phil Jackson quote, I believe. I asked someone who would know. I said, did the fans have to smuggle in these cowbells like someone at a concert trying to bring in some contraband? And it's now blown into a thing where when you bring a cowbell, like, and you put it on the little plastic table at the security thing.
Right, like the metal detector area, right?
At the metal detector, and the security guards are like, nice cowbell. So that's something I want to see more cowbells at playoff pick games. That's basically my pitch there. But to the team that Sacramento does have such a high cushion over, Phoenix, KD returns last night. Great game down the stretch against Minnesota. They're 4-0 with Kevin Durant in the lineup. He's doing interviews about his legacy. Like, I personally, just like Kevin Durant, I don't care what his, like, what the stakes of his Phoenix tenure means for how good of an NBA player he is on the pantheon of league greats. I just want to see this team healthy and see what they can become. Because, like, to me, I'm trying to look at the playoff picture from just my coverage standpoint as like a Game of Thrones or a Succession type, you know, who are these? Each team was like a character in a sense of like what their narrative arc is, not from the, you know, how can we paint this narrative to, you know, drive whatever that people accuse us, certain reporters of such. But like the Suns are the super team that's left in the West. That's it. They're the only one. Like, they're the only one that that made such splashy headlines to, like, get them some things together. And I just it'll be interesting to have them at full strength and to see what can come from a KD, Devin Booker, Chris Paul, DeAndre Ayton unit. Because who knows? I mean, the way the superstar carousel spins, there ain't no guarantee that those four guys are going to be the iteration of the Phoenix Suns moving forward. I can pretty much guarantee you Devin Booker and Kevin Durant are going to be there.
Right.
And I don't think that's me breaking any, you know, crazy news. I mean, DeAndre Ayton had to go get an offer sheet just to get the contract salary figure he wanted from Phoenix. Chris Paul was being thrown around in trade talks in February. There's still the Kyrie Irving lingering rumors as, you know, we'll get to Dallas later in the play-in push. So I'm just curious to see if I'm hoping we see Phoenix. I mean, I want everyone to be healthy. The playoffs are going to be a war of attrition. It's a 2-month-long marathon. But that's my takeaway with Phoenix here after watching them last night. Like, I just want to be able to see this thing have an earned shot. I don't care if they win. I don't care if they look good. I just want them to be healthy because it'd be fun to see this team at full strength actually be more than just an idea on paper.
which is weirdly like the thing that has traveled with Kevin Durant for the last few seasons, right? How does the team actually perform on paper on the court now that we've all envisioned what it might look like? The realities in the early returns are kind of incredible. 84 minutes with Booker and Durant on the court together, the Suns are plus 53. They're scoring at an even higher rate than the rates of offensive efficiency that the Nets had when they had Durant and Irving and Harden all on the floor together. It has looked incredible. You can just stretch defenses and put them in the Cobra clutch when you have them spotting up off of an action, Durant in the slot, Booker in the corner, or whatever, with Chris Paul running a high pick and roll with DeAndre Ayton. You can't help. Ayton's going to get dunks if you step up. Paul's hitting the floater. He's passing off to one of the great shooters in our world to hit a spot up three. Like it's a dangerous, dangerous thing. The only thing that could slow them down or stop them is just, are they not healthy enough when it matters most? And are you not getting quite enough out of that number five spot? Josh Okogie has played fantastic this season. It's been really cool to see him become like a player of consequence on a team that matters. And they've pieced together enough other stuff. Cameron Payne, Landry Shamet coming back, Ish Wainwright, like the Torrey Craig, TJ Warren, that sort of mishmash second unit has been better than I think a lot of us anticipated it might be when the number one call was they traded away all their depth. Well, yeah, but those guys that are left can still play too. I think that the issue is just if you're in a four, they're going to be in the 4-5 in all likelihood. They're five games back of Sacramento now at this point. The concern is they're only a game and a half out of six. Now we start wondering who's going to be jockeying for what position. As we just talked about, people want Sacramento as opposed to other matchups. But the Suns are going to have to deal with somebody serious in round one, no matter whether that's Kawhi with the Clippers, the full strength Warriors, an increasingly interesting and dangerous Wolves team, or Sacramento that's had the best offense in the world for the whole year. So it's the concerns for Phoenix are just, can you get all the guys that you need on the court when it matters healthy? Because what we've seen so far, the early returns look like it's about as dangerous as we all anticipated.
There you go. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with a full breakdown of the play-in push TM. This is No Cap Room on the Ball Don't Lie podcast feed.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right, we are back. Jake Fisher, Dan Devine, thanks for sticking with us. We're recording this again Thursday morning, March 30th. So I've been told we're coming out in the afternoon. So if you're rocking with us today, it's a nice little preview appetizer for tonight's two games that do not really involve the play and push altogether. So this has some shelf life also to set things up for the weekend. As things currently stand and the play-in, like we were saying at the top of this, it's dramatically changed the league. It's made these games more, more stakes involved. And
meaningful games in late March is something that I think for a very long time we just did not have. And now it seems like there's a handful of consequence every night.
Every single night. So right now, Miami is in pole position of seven. I mean, they've kind of been in this back and forth with Brooklyn trying to get out of six for a long time here, and it just doesn't feel like the Nets want to relinquish it. Mikal Bridges, your boy.
My boy.
Your sweet baby boy, Mikal Bridges, that you have shared your story 17,000 times about. He just won't let Brooklyn let go of the sixth seed. So I'm not even going to allow you to say a Mikal thing because we got to just keep this thing rolling here. We're sticking with Miami. Look. They're a team. They're the patented. Nobody wants to see them in the playoffs. If everyone wants to see Sacramento, no one wants to see Eric Spoelstra and Jimmy Butler and go down the list. Jimmy, I think. I mean, he said it. He came out and said it that he tries harder when the games start to get more serious.
Right.
And it seems like it. I mean, the dude morphs into a top 10, arguably top 5 player in the playoffs every single year. when you think of Jimmy Butler, like on his epitaph, there will just be a picture of him, you know, hunched over in the bubble. That's like the defining image of his career, playoff Jimmy. Any quick thoughts here on Miami? I mean, I'm curious to see where their ultimate outcome becomes, being that, I mean, this team is not trying to be the seventh seed, right?
Right.
They have much higher expectations. They were in that finals run 2020. They were in the Eastern Conference Finals, even again after that. And there's a lot at stake here with them being, you know, Kyle Lowry's contract situation is certainly curious, and he was in a lot of trade talk. We've got Gabe Vincent and Max Strus contracts coming up. They were searching for some type of real front court partner for Bam Adebayo and never really found it. So I'm very interested to see how Miami ultimately, stretches this out here, because they're just, for a quote-unquote contender with all the star power that they have, they've got so many undrafted guys, and they're not the exact makeup that you would expect from a team that has such high expectations.
Yeah, the thing that stands out to me with them is that when they have their main guys on the floor, they're awesome. When they've had Jimmy and Bam Adebayo and Tyler Herro on the floor together, they've outscored teams by 8.3 points per 100 possessions, according to Cleaning the Glass. They've been, that is an elite caliber of performance. And Jimmy is, you know, as you said, maybe playing the best ball of his career right now. He's been awesome since the All-Star break. Look at the impact stats, like estimated plus minus, and he's like a top five, top 10 player. Bam, maybe like a legitimate defensive player of the year candidate again, probably a little bit below the tier of somebody like Jaren Jackson Jr. and Brooke Lopez and Evan Mobley, but like right there. It's just the rest of it around that never came together. They went into the season. We kind of knew they needed another. They needed to replace that PJ Tucker spot. They needed another, somebody else to go into that lineup. They needed another creator. And the hope was that Kyle Lowry, after last season missing a bunch of time for personal issues and with injuries, would be that guy this season. That just has not worked out. They never really found the replacement for PJ Tucker beyond Caleb Martin, who has been great in the role, but it is only, he is a tier below what they need in that spot. And just nothing else around it. Like all of their other bets, Max Strus hasn't been quite as good as he was last year. Victor Oladipo hasn't quite been what they had hoped for. Duncan Robinson continues the decline from the form that got him a contract a couple of years ago. And there's sort of like all of those coin flips. Kevin Love at the buyout deadline. It's fine, but it's not what you really need. So they are one of those teams where their best answer might be like Jimmy and Bam and Herro play like 42 minutes a game. And I'm a little bit facetious, but like honestly, they're really good when those guys are on the floor, and they're not when they're not. And I don't know that there's like a better answer in the waiting for them. And especially if you're in a situation now where you have to just like burn the boats behind you, like Spo would like to say, and say, we're moving forward. That might be kind of their only shot, especially with the other guys in that court, like Jimmy getting up there in age, Lowry getting up there in age. Like if they want to have any shot at, catching lightning in a bottle and making a run here, it might just be those guys like leaning on them as hard as possible.
So if things hold and Miami stays at seven, they'll see Atlanta at eight in the 7-8 game that will be in Miami. The loser would then host the winner of the 9-10, which is currently Toronto and Chicago. And the Hawks Heat rematch would be interesting to me, because I say rematch being that they met in the first round last year. And the fact that Miami kind of swept the floor with Atlanta, I believe it was a gentleman's sweep, 4-1. And I remember there was some game-winning shot or a close shot that Trae Young hit to kind of like save their season. And I had a bunch of people. If you really want to get off task, the people who were in my apartment that night—that's a whole wild story. But I'm gonna save that.
Another time, maybe another time for that.
Another
one.
Time. It involves 23andMe and finding out a whole family tree that never existed. I'll give that teaser there, but I remember I stood up and hit a light bulb and it broke. And then I had to spend overtime or the last crunch time, whatever it was, sweeping this glass off the floor. And that's neither here nor there. But Miami shattered Atlanta.
Oh, my God. I saw it, Jake. It's very clear what you did there.
In all seriousness, I think that, I mean, there was a lot of undertones before that, but I think just the way they were decimated by Miami really set the tone for that offseason. And so it'll be interesting from that standpoint of how Atlanta, they're this kind of retool group now with Quinn Snyder at the fold. They get the devil that kind of took them out a year ago when, I mean, there was some vagueness and gray to it, but the messaging out of Atlanta has been very clear that Quinn Snyder was brought in this part of the season and not, you know, wait until the offseason, in part to, quote unquote, evaluate the players moving forward. So, I mean, you're going right back against the same beast that led you to evaluate your players right. last offseason. It's just that dynamic is, I keep saying things are interesting to me, but that's what it is. It is interesting to me. Yeah. Dan Devine, what say you?
I think the Hawks feel like a team that, I mean, obviously they anticipated they would be much better than this because you don't go out and make the trade they did for DeJounte Murray and give up that draft capital and you know, get off of Kevin Huerter so that you can have the luxury tax flexibility to bring in Murray and commit to him, hopefully long-term, all that kind of stuff, if you don't think you're going to be much better than what they've been. But the reality is like, they've just been like the textbook definition of mid for forever, right? That stat, I think it was John Schumann from NBA.com was the first one really tracking it, that they've been within one game of 500 since January 14th. It's March 30th, 2.5 months of just being one game or the other side of 500. It's brutally average. It's as mediocre can be without being like 15th in offense, 15th in defense, 15th in net rating, 15th in every other category. It's just, there's no reason to believe that it's going to be dramatically different with this set of characters under Quinn Snyder. They're 7-8 since Snyder took over, 4th in offensive efficiency, 24th on defense, which is basically what you figure the Hawks would be. They're going to be a really good offense. They're going to be bad on defense, despite having multiple good to very good defensive players. It just seems like a team that is significantly less than the sum of its parts. And I don't know how that changes outside of some of those parts changing this offseason, which, as you mentioned, is kind of, this is an evaluation period where they're going to see who do we really want to commit to moving forward. And there's so many interesting sort of questions with that, because you have got Clint Capella on the extension, but you've also got Onyeka Okongwu. What do you want to do with, at some point he's going to need more minutes because he deserves them and he's the future of the position as opposed to its past. There's the broader questions of John Collins. Every time we talk, we're like, what the hell is going to happen with John Collins? I think John Collins is also wondering what the hell is going to happen with John Collins. There's so many sort of variables for them. I don't really know what we're going to learn in these next few weeks. But the hope is for them, Trae Young keeps shooting the ball well. That offense can carry it through the play-in tournament, at least to another postseason berth. And then you've got something to build off of maybe moving forward.
Toronto at 9 is kind of in a different, maybe even the opposite perspective, being that, no, it's just more the fact that Atlanta has moved on and like at least they've nailed down who their coach is going to be for the foreseeable future. A lot can happen here. I mean, that's the overall context I have been saying for, you know, ever since the deadline ended about any, you know, potential look ahead here, because if the Raptors get out of the play-in tournament and make the conference finals, like, you know, who, like, Toronto hasn't been preparing for that. Like, things are going to change. Like, I mean, that's the same case for anybody. If someone falls short, if someone gets hurt, you know, there's just so much that can happen here. But look, it's been a conversation since the deadline. And as we get closer to the end of the season and coaches around the league are looking at potential openings, like, that is one that people discuss. Like, I don't think that's some giant secret. I mean, the Raptors clearly thought they were going to build off of being the sixth seed last year. Scottie Barnes, rookie of the year, is supposed to take another leap. And the expectations, I mean, they've been very, you know, improved, I believe, since the Okorafor addition at the trade deadline. But there is definitely a lot at stake here with Toronto from top to bottom, just being that they have a lot of potential, you know, blocks of the Jenga tower to move around with Fred VanVleet and Gary Trent. I mean, every name that didn't get moved at the deadline is going to be resurfaced again. That's just how this stuff works.
To look at it, VanVleet being on a player option, Trent on a player option, you'd have to imagine both those guys are going to exercise those, get out into the market, and see what kind of offers they can get there. OG Anunoby, the reason everybody was talking about him as potentially the biggest piece to move at the trade deadline before Kevin Durant moved at the trade deadline, there was the sense that this is like the kind of player that so many teams need, right? Multiple offers of multiple first round picks for OG Anunoby out there. That's going to come back around. You don't get that far down the road without at least revisiting those conversations. Pirtle has been like a weirdly transformational figure for the Raptors. They're 12-8 since they got him. I think they're outscoring teams by like 10 points per 100 possessions with him on the floor. Imagine that. Having a center to protect the rim has been pretty helpful for them.
He's also very good.
Oh, he's fantastic. Yeah, he's not just like insert replacement level player here, but when they finally were like, well, let's put a 7-footer back there to protect the rim and then organize all those wings toward like funneling things to him, everything kind of started to click. And another like dribble handoff setter, passer, high post facilitator, all that kind of stuff. Another guy to move the ball helped their offense make so much more sense. And that's the good news. The bad news is he's about to be an unrestricted free agent who's making like $9.4 million a year. He's going to want more than that. How do you figure all that out?
Look, I'm just going to interrupt you very quickly.
Yeah, go for it.
They don't trade a first round pick plus stuff, not knowing the general salary range that he wants. I mean, it's been very, I think, widely reported by myself and others that he wants something in the 20, you know, range. And just like with Josh Hart in New York, like you don't trade a first round pick for that guy without at least planning to, you know, stomach the number that you think he wants.
And that's completely, that's a fair, reasonable number for somebody who's entering his prime. Pirtle's 27 years old and who fits what they do. And you know, there's the cultural fit, all that kind of stuff, but it just means you're going to have to figure out where that money comes from elsewhere. And with so many other sort of balls in the air, as you're juggling, something's going to fall and hit the carpet. Right. And so the question is, how does that or change the way that Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster and everybody has built this team, the identity that they've wanted to foster for this team? I don't know what the answer to that is. And I'm wondering, I don't know that we're going to find out the answers to those questions based on the outcome of the 9-10 game or if they can move up from there. But the fact that they've looked so much more sort of balanced and settled over the last, you know, 15, 20 games, I think it would lead me to wonder if they're like, this is an organizational shift in terms of what we believe we got to prioritize. It's not just interchangeable everywhere. There still needs to be some differentiation and definition. And then how do we arrive at that while maybe letting go some of the guys that have been so key to our identity for the last handful of years?
And I think, I mean, the play-in tournament environment has been so fun with this single elimination, you know, aspect, and the 9-10 game being in Toronto where they've got a wild fan base will be awesome. As of now, they're supposed to play, or they're on track to play Chicago, who's two games up on Washington.
Your boys, your Chicago Bulls.
Listen, when I was at the Clippers Bulls game, I got a little excited. I was like, oh, the Bulls are close. And I mean, the Wizards and Pacers, just they're dead to me at this point. Not in long term. I have a lot of love for what the Pacers are building. I have a lot of love for a lot of people in the Washington Wizards organization. It's a little bit precarious that they're going to be tripling down. We have doubling down written in the notes here, but tripling down on a Kuzma, Bradley Beal, Kristaps Porzingis trio that obviously there's been health issues and whatnot, but they're 11th right now. I mean, this is definitely a team that didn't have championship expectations, but they wanted to be around six. They wanted to be fighting to get out of the, they wanted to be fighting in the play-in push, TM, to get out of the play-in. And they're not. So,
well, yeah. And the point to your point, they're talking, you know, the reporting is that Kristaps Porzingis is sort of engaged in conversations on an extension.
He wants to stay there. I know that very confidently. So it makes sense that they're at least talking about it.
And I think the number that I saw was it could go up to 4-180. Is that right?
That ain't happening. That's the maximum he could do.
Yeah. And so
I would guess this is just pure educated guess. I would guess the number ends up somewhere in like that Kyle Lowry range of 390, 3100. That's a deal I think that would be like a good benchmark for a lot of like fringe all-star, you know, guys at kind of the end of their prime, or, you know, not so smack dab and they're not still on the rise that are looking for that next big deal. That's kind of the number I think Fred VanVleet too, you know, that's something I'm looking at for those two guys.
Which raises Kuzma as a really interesting player, because different kind of player, but also hasn't had the big, like Kristaps is coming off the max, right? There are guys who have met, who Kyle has made a ton of money in his career. Kuzma has not. I mean, coming off of a decent contract, but $13 million a year, different than that kind of overwhelming money that we've talked about some of the other guys. If you're already looking at 80 something year and north of that to keep for Beal and Porzingis on an extension. What's the number that gets you Kuzma for 4 or 5 years? Is that 20 plus? You'd figure it'd have to be, right? So then you're talking about locking in, what, like $105 million with the arrow pointing up for the next 5 years for a trio that has outscored people by 4.5 points per 100 when they've been healthy and on the court this year? Like, maybe finding the pieces around them that gooses that number makes it a more palatable thing. But, like, I don't know. Yeah, you are locking in an, again, core, which there's worse things than that. I mean, is one thing, and, like, absolute in the toilet trash is a different one. And so maybe they just want to try to provide whatever sort of bumpers on the side of the gutters so that they don't go all the way into them. But I don't know, man. That's a tough place to be. But it's also that place that you wind up when you make the decision that they've made with Beal. Understandably, like, you don't want to just walk away from a guy that's been the face of your franchise that you've built everything around, but it leaves precious few outs for building moving forward from there.
Okay, let's flip it to the Western Conference. I'm going to try to move this a little bit more quickly here. Minnesota at 7. They're finally healthy. Cat's back. Just like with Phoenix, like, I want to be able to see this thing in action. I want to be able to see them have a dominant pick-and-roll duo on the floor at all times of Mike Conley and Rudy Gobert and Ant and Cat. We've got more on Conley and Gobert coming at Yahoo this week. I have to write that after we record. I mean, the Lakers, I don't know what to make of the Lakers. The Austin Reeves hype machine right now, or not even the hype machine, just the amount of attention he's getting is just, he's a great player. I like Austin Reeves a lot. It seems like there's this weird apparatus hovering around his name because he looks like Alex Caruso and plays for the Lakers. That's really,
well,
it.
That's, I mean, yeah, yes. There's a great white hope component to it for sure. But he's responded really well to the role that they've had, that they've needed him to play. He's another guy who can dribble, pass, and shoot. He's averaging like 6 free throw attempts per game since the All-Star break. Like,
he's been their third best player all year. He's been their third best player from start to finish.
And that, like, elevating him to the starting lineup, you know, moving Malik Beasley, who's been struggling a lot, out of that first unit, and being able to run out a first five of a healthy Anthony Davis, LeBron James, Vanderbilt, Reeves, and D'Angelo Russell, there's some juice there. So I understand the optimism with the Lakers. I think that's what a lot of us kind of anticipated it might look like once they made those deals at the deadline. It's just, it gets really easy for everybody to get really excited about the Lakers really fast, in part because of LeBron, in part because of the Lakers, in part because of the novelty of something like Austin Reeves sort of jumping off the page. It's just, I don't know, man. They've been 4 or 5 different teams this season, and none of them have been particularly good. So I kind of want to see I'll need to see them knock off one of these 1 or 2 seeds before I believe they're making the run all the way to the finals, like some members of our esteemed community.
the Pelicans' chances, I mean, just really seem to come down to if Zion will be healthy, obviously, and there's just no guarantee, man. It sucks. I mean, when the guy's healthy, he's literal franchise changing talent and like a automatic all-star starter. That's just what we've seen. But he's just, I mean, Ingram's kind of gone into God mode, and he's someone who I'm definitely expecting, this will definitely get aggregated. I'm just expecting teams will call about him this summer because he's really good and there isn't exactly a clear pathway. I'm not saying that, like, shame on the Pelicans, there's no pathway moving forward here. That's just the unfortunate situation they're in with Zion and the inability to project when he'll actually be on the floor. So being the way this NBA marketplace works, I'm sure there are going to be teams that call and swoop in and try to see if they can pry Brandon Ingram loose there. But the team I really want to just touch on here in the play-in push is OKC, because they're always fun to watch. They will have at least, if they make it, if they can hold off the stumbling and, you know, just absolutely, I was trying to come up with a metaphor here, but they're just, I don't want to say anything that is too offensive because what's coming is, I mean, the Mavericks are.
Let's try to avoid saying anything overly offensive.
The Mavericks are just a car like rolling off a cliff right now. That's just what it is. And the Thunder, I think, a lot of teams in the league are looking at the Thunder as a team to be kind of afraid of over the next couple of seasons. They are. They're arriving a little bit ahead of schedule. Chet Holmgren's going to be whipped up and, you know, buffered and shined and ready to go for, you know, his actual rookie year. Got another couple top picks coming through. And I think in the national TV elimination environment, that's like where Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is going to thrive. That's where he's thrived all year. So I kind of am looking at them where I was looking at the Pelicans a year ago as this team that could be a sneaky, you know, we use this play-in tournament to push all this momentum forward. And can this be like a springboard into next season? They seem to look like that's how they're looking at this. I mean, Mark Dangenal has got that group playing super, super hard. I mean, that Pistons game last night was a little bit of like a grind, but that's just the one takeaway I see every time. I mean, it's not just Lu Dort. Like, right, everyone on the Thunder, they are coming at you. Defensively, they are nasty. They are physical. Josh Giddey doesn't, you know, isn't afraid of anybody. It's an awesome team to watch, man.
Yeah, that a young team defends this well, this consistently. And it's not like a smoke and mirrors kind of defense where they can't protect the rim, so that they throw all the they do. I mean, they pressure the ball really well and they do force turnovers, but it's young guys following rules. It's the right rotations. It's on time help. It's nailing the little stuff about NBA defenses that young guys so often struggle with. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander being somebody who is actively a point of attack defender and working to get around screens, like, superstars don't always do that, right? You're carrying a giant workload in terms of scoring and setting up your teammates. You take the time off on the other end. We're kind of used to that by now. He's kind of setting an example there by being an active participant in that defense alongside Dort, alongside Jalen Williams, who is, I'm not sure that the cresting J-Dub for Rookie of the Year movement is going to reach its, is it going to actually across the finish line? But he's been nothing short of fantastic for a couple of months now. And that alongside Giddey growing his game, his jumper coming along, his aggression north-south coming along, there's so much to be excited about. Our colleague Ben Rohrbach had written that, I think it was maybe a month and a half ago or so. It's like, it's time to take them seriously. This is not a cute story that's going to fall away in the, you know, before you get to the spring. Like, they believe that he has an SGA is going to make an all NBA team. I don't know which one, but he's going to make one of them. He's going to wind up on MVP ballots.
Stupid. His numbers are stupid.
And have been since the start of the season.
I didn't realize how big of a jump until I heard the guys over on the Tampering Pod, The Athletic, talking about it. I saw a clip on Twitter. I didn't realize how big of a jump he made at free throw rate. And, I mean, he's knocking them down at 91%. I mean, the guys, I remember, this is going to be a weird flex. I was the first person to call Kawhi the Terminator.
Okay.
I was.
Okay.
I just remember a young San Antonio Spurs, Kawhi Leonard. It was game six of one of the, I don't remember the
year.
Was
this back in your What's Up with Sports column and middle school? When
was
this?
I was on the night desk at SI at this time. Okay. Right. I was out of college. And I forget what year it was, but it was game six against the Grizzlies. It was before he won finals MVP. Mm-hmm. And the dude, he scored like 20 straight points through end of fourth quarter and overtime, and also got like seven stops on himself by himself. Like, he literally had four steals and like two blocks in that stretch. And I was just so taken by how, like, he was just there to smite you and didn't really right. show any real other emotions. And Shai kind of has a bit of the, he's not as like, I am a robot as Kawhi is, but just in terms of like, this dude is a machine that is coming and isn't stopping. He's a stud. He is an absolute stud.
Well, when players announce that they belong with their, not just with their production, but with their demeanor, with the sort of very clear, you know, when you see it, self-possession and belief of like, I'm not trying to get to your level. I'm already there. And
trying to make you think I'm better than you. That's where I'm at right now.
Yeah, you are going to be afraid of me by the end of this possession, quarter, game, whatever. He's been doing that. So he started doing it last year. It was just that no one was paying attention to the Thunder because they took themselves out of the running, and he only played a certain, you know, a pretty limited number of games because of injury and then because of being taken out of the running. But it became clear watching him the second half of last year, like, this dude is the truth. And then he took another step beyond that at the very beginning of the season. And, you know, you've joked about it before. Like, I wrote about that pretty early. I'm like, this guy's an all-star now. Like, it's happening this year. I don't know what the Thunder's record is going to be, but he's going to be. And one of the responses I got to that pretty quickly from Thunder fans and from other people watching was like, he might be all NBA right now. And I kind of thought, it's a long way away. Well, that's the springtime. We'll see about when we get there. We're there. When you have that dude who comports himself that way and produces against the best defenders in the world again and again and again, it makes everybody else believe too. And that reduces pressure on everybody else in their complementary roles. It emboldens them to take another further step forward. They can get their job done too. And every player in that Thunder rotation continues to respond like, yeah, no, I'm supposed to be here. I'm supposed to do this. I don't know if obviously matchups are going to be a huge part of this, who they wind up facing in which position in the play-in tournament. They have so many of the ingredients you need to win games and maybe even a series in the playoffs. Whether it all comes together in time for them against who they need to knock off, we'll see. But it's incredibly encouraging to look at that, what is already there, that core, and say, you're adding Chet Holmgren to that. I think it's 15 first round picks over the next 7 drafts. I might have that number wrong, but something like that. Just so many ingredients, plus other young guys that are just have an opportunity to get better too. Center Jalen Williams, Jay Will, Trey Mann. You know, there's talent around. The guys who never, these sort of unsung heroes, your Jeremiah Robinson Earls and your Aaron Wiggins. Like, there's other guys who can play. There's just so many opportunities to find something special there. It's a lot of fun to watch. And I would not want to deal with them if I was a favorite team, just because that team is not concerned about whether you think they should be there already. They already are.
They're also in a spot just like Memphis was a year ago, which Memphis didn't end up doing anything with it, but where they're going to have cap space before this thing gets really expensive. And I think I know there are some teams in the West who are definitely curious and are a little bit, I don't want to say they're like shaking in their boots, but they're a little bit worried about what the Thunder could do and how they could make this thing even better outside of all the draft capital they have.
The one note I want to say before we leave the play-in push in the West is, you mentioned that the main thing that the Pelicans have to, everything hangs on Zion's health. And that's inarguably true. One thing
though, I meant in terms of like getting out and making it into like an actual first round series.
100%. And what their chances would be in one of those series. I do have to note, though, for Pelicans fans, if you're listening, all is not lost. You have an important weapon in your favor, which is that our editor, Joe Garza, refuses to let me write about the Pelicans again. He is a Pelicans fan in his own personal rooting interest. And I pitched writing about how Brandon Ingram has been going God mode recently and how the need to find more offense without Zion, they've shaken some things up and the shooting has come around. Trey Murphy's been fantastic in the starting lineup. Jonas Valanciunas, more touches, yada, yada, yada. And his response to me was, you stay the hell away from my team. So if you were concerned that when Dan Devine writes about your team, something falls off of an important player or they just completely disintegrate, fret not, Pelicans, because I've been told that I'm not allowed to write about them for a little while. So please take that positive energy and move forward into the play-in tournament with my regards. I know I see you and I know it's all going well, but I'm not allowed to tell anybody else about it, because if I do that, I'm going to totally kibosh your whole deal.
Well, you also, as we shifted to our next segment, the vibe check, you also choosing to write about Jaren Jackson Jr. and then he doesn't play last night.
How it works out. It all shakes out.
Dan Devine jinx. You also wrote, you wrote in December or so that the Pelicans had arrived and they were, championship contenders, and they immediately, stumbled down the standings to get into the play-in push.
2 weeks later, Zion pulls up and it's like, well, good job, Devine.
Yeah. The vibe check every week, we're going to focus on one team or a player and just check the temperature, see what's up. You have been paying attention to the Grizzlies. They were on a 7-game win streak until Russell Westbrook went 2013 Russell Westbrook on them. And it's, I mean, when Russ is hot, it's fun to watch, man. I was at the Clippers Bulls game again, as I've said 17 times, and my media seat was like, it was a great view, but it was the weirdest seat I've ever had in terms of the, there was a row of fans whose like knees were in my back. Like they were right on top of us. And these four dudes.
It usually just feels like that. It just feels like the fans' knees are on our backs and our necks. It's not usually literal.
It was literally like when I had to get up, like I had to ask them to stand up so I could push my chair back. It was an intimate feeling. But these guys were so into Russ, like they wanted to know what corner of the court he was going to like run out and do his like pregame thing. And I was like, man, how could you still be like living and dying with Russell Westbrook? Like he's, you know, your favorite pop star when people like cry when they see Bad Bunny play. And then like he does what he did last night. And it's like, yeah, Russ is awesome. Like he's awesome. Memphis, really quickly, what are your vibes on the Grizzlies, man? I mean, Ja's back. He looks great. They, you know, we spilled a lot of ink and spoken a lot about that whole situation. Let's kind of put that in the rear view, all things considered. You know, they're dancing out on the court. Dylan Brooks is doing Dylan Brooks things. I mean, people have just also largely around the league looked at Memphis, not like Sacramento, but kind of raised an eyebrow and been like, dude, you guys haven't done anything yet. Why are you talking so much? Prove it. Will they prove it, do you think?
The reason I wanted to write about them and the reason I wanted to write about Jaren Jackson Jr. in particular is there was a real like inflection point moment when Ja goes away and they're like, it's how do they score? Because everything in that offense has been so oriented around Ja Morant with the live dribble and the high pick and roll, right? Not enough shooting around them, not enough other complementary pieces to create offense. It's all Ja, Ja, Ja. And what they've done, and it's, you know, the story, it'll be out on Yahoo Sports. I don't know if it's this afternoon or tomorrow. We'll see. But a lot of it is, oh, wait, Jaren Jackson Jr. was the number four pick in the draft coming out of Michigan State, and he's got all this other talent that we don't really use a whole lot. And so they've been forcing him more touches, getting him more shots, giving him more opportunities to play from all over the court. And it's unlocked some stuff in their half-court offense. That's been the knock on Memphis for the last couple of years. They can play in transition. If they force turnovers and they run on the break, they're lights out. Get him in the half court, force him to create against the set defense, and they're going to buckle. And before Ja went out, they were, I think, 22nd in half-court offense. And since, they've been about league average, maybe a little bit better than that. And a lot of that is Jaren Jackson Jr. moving around the floor and getting to attack mismatches in a variety of ways, whether it's slower defender from the facing up from the perimeter, smaller guy back to the basket. And Luke Kennard, I was kind of low on that at the trade deadline. I was like, that's not changing your life. But adding another shooter alongside Desmond Bane decongests that offense and it makes defenses pay. So we'll get into this a lot more in the article that'll be up. But the silver lining, to the extent that there is one, in a situation like Ja leaving midstream with all the issues that surrounded that, is it forced Memphis to have to figure out what else was in the cupboard. And I think they might have come away with some answers that helped them in the playoffs that maybe they didn't have, or they didn't quite have as much access to this time last year. So will they get there? It's a boring answer to say. So much of it depends upon matchups. They could be the 2 seed and then wind up with Golden State in round one. And it's like, well, Jesus Christ, come on, man. Like, that's no fair. Who do I complain to about this? But I'll tell you.
They wouldn't complain. They would take that as an opportunity to beat them and then say, this is a rivalry. Because that's Golden State's whole thing.
100%.
They haven't lost to you.
But as a dispassionate observer of these sorts of things, you look at it and you say, well, what matchup don't you want to have to deal with right away? And it's dealing with Steph Curry right off the rip, right? And
oh, so, yeah, like, for sure.
I mean, Minnesota obviously gave them a ton of problems last year, and the offensive rebounding that kind of put Memphis over the top with Brandon Clark, that's not you don't have access to that because Clark's out for the season. So that would be a tough matchup for them. The Lakers, you know, there's not, and nobody's going to be fun to play in that 7-2-7 matchup, but I think they maybe, their vibe is they feel like they've sort of survived something very concerning and also come out the other side with some more answers than maybe they had before, which I think is interesting in a West where people continue to feel like it's, you know, it's going to be really open depending on who faces who.
They've also had to mix and match a lot in terms of trying to figure out how to overcome losing Steven Adams. And that's, I feel like it's kind of unlocked Santi Aldama. A little shout out there.
Xavier Tillman has been incredible for them in that role. Like, he went from being the third string center that just didn't really play to starting, and they have not skipped a beat with him in the middle there for Steven Adams. And there's still that possibility, remote maybe that Adams is back on the floor too. So they could wind up being in having developed some really positive things in the middle of a pretty dark time.
Could have been it could go down also as a stealthy, great trade. 3 second-round picks for Luke Kennard. Mm. But we'll see how beneficial his stroke can be. Last time I looked, he was number one three-point shooter in the league. The guy is sizzling. So
54% in Memphis. 54%.
There you go. That's the homework, kid. I am Jake Fisher. Do you want Tales from the Ranch before we get out of here? Do you want a quick little?
I mean, I think the listeners deserve some. I have been.
Listeners deserve.
My number one thing, and on our rundown here, it has Dan, how was swim class? One of my kids got sick last weekend, so I didn't even go to swim class. So not only was I not at swim class, I was like in the apartment reading to a sick child, which obviously dad of the
year. What did you read? What did you read?
What did we read last weekend? Honestly, I don't remember. So let's say it wasn't Goodnight Moon. It was something else. But, whatever book she wanted. The answer is whatever book she wanted, because when the 5-year-old is sick and you say, like, can I read you a story? She just pulls down whatever you want from the shelf until she falls asleep. But so I wasn't even getting out of the house, let alone to the hospitable climes of a ranch outside Reno, Nevada, where I have been told by my friend, bring things I can get muddy in. So, Jake,
yeah,
how muddy did you get?
We'll make this quick.
Make it long. Well, keep it in and double it.
We pull up a late Thursday night, and I was concerned from the get-go about phone service. Not that, like, it got cathartic at a certain point, but, like, we turned off a dirt road 2 hours outside of Reno. We pulled onto a dirt road 2 hours outside of Reno, and just I watched the bars disappear one by one.
Right.
And there was, I mean, it was the most remote location I've been to in the continental United States, like in the valley of these mountains in northern Nevada, where on Friday we like took ATVs and dirt bikes and four-wheelers up to like check out this old coal mine, and I felt like we were straight out of Mad Max Fury Road because there was nobody around but like us kicking up dirt, and like if you rode too far behind the vehicle in front of you, you were just getting sand in your teeth left and right. And it was so cold too. We were going so fast, and there was no like windshield protector that like we all got like wind burn on our faces. Like mm-hmm. It looked like we were just out in the sun. It was a lot of mud. Like the place got absolutely flooded because apparently, as everyone on the West Coast is well aware, like they're just getting pelted with rain, and that's also ruined my week in LA a little bit. And like we had to, this is the one muddy story I will. There was this old saloon on the property, like literally like barn, like swinging barn doors, like out of the Wild West.
Right.
And the path to get it was completely flooded. And me and the rancher, this like 65-year-old retired hippie, half Norwegian, half Mojave Indian, him and I took these mud boots to like go check out the ranch and like see if it was still functional. And that was a time. That was, I mean, knee deep with like, I'd never been in like knee high rubber boots that like protect you from whatever swamp is in the water beneath you. And yeah, I can confidently say the word unique gets thrown around way too liberally in our society. That was a unique experience that I don't think I will ever have again.
I'm glad you had it. I'm glad you did not allow your concerns and your complaints to prevent you from having that experience. I do want to ask you, though, when you are told, so the plan is we're going to ride our war rigs out to an abandoned coal mine. Are you a little worried you're going to die? Are you like, is there a small amount of concern that like, oh, I'm going to wind up in a mine and I'm never coming back?
Yeah, the guy kept saying, oh, the last time I did this, we broke down and I had to walk 11 miles home to get the Ford F-150 to come tow back the ATVs. So he kept saying it, and I was like, is this a joke? Are you just messing with us? And there were several times where we did have to leave a vehicle on the side of the road. And he was like, oh, we'll just come back and get it later because there's no one's going to steal this. Like, there's literally not a soul for like miles and miles. And then there was snow. Certain things couldn't get through the snow. And like there was an ice patch. And a guy, I mean, I watched an ATV holding four dudes like nearly flip over and cascade down a cliff like the Dallas Mavericks are doing right now to bring that back to completion. It was not the safest place I've been. That there was a lot that could have gone wrong, but to pull up to like a thing that was built in 1906 that was like the lifeblood of that whole entire region and like see a little bit of the machinery was cool. I don't know. When you're like at a place like that, like I remember when I went to OKC in December, I walked over to the Land Run Memorial because I had read about it in the great book Boomtown. And I don't know. I feel like when you can like close your eyes and feel like something crazy went down here, it's interesting.
Well, that was gonna be my last question because I know we got to move. But you have described in conversations with me two very different kinds of isolation experiences. One is I am 2 hours outside of Reno, Nevada, about to go into an abandoned coal mine. And one is I am in North Brooklyn about to go into a sensory deprivation tank.
Yeah.
Which version of isolation?
The tank wasn't public though, right? That was a test show.
Oh, well, it's public now. So
it's public now. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
So which version of isolation did you prefer?
Well, that was like away from the world with a group of people. And I can tell you by the end of it, I was ready to
You're
be
ready
alone.
For the world?
Yeah. And the sensory deprivation tank, I booked the day after the trade deadline. And for those unaffiliated with the story, and it was out of a movie. Like I felt like I was in Severance walking into this weird bougie place in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And yeah, I closed the door behind me and I had this mud scrub and you have to, you know, to shower off clean. And I laid in the water for an hour and just, it was silent after like, I mean, we tried to record a test show after the deadline and my eyes were literally about to glaze. Like I thought I was going to lose vision with how, like trying to stare at the camera and talk to you, not because of you. You're beautiful to look at.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
It was, I mean, you were a grumpy boy that day.
I was extremely grumpy. Yes. Well, what I like about this, though, Jake, is that we're learning that no matter which coast you're on, what sort of activity you're going for, mud is going to be part of it. Like there was a mud scrub before the tank. There was mud in the fields, out on the ranch. So we're just going to have to look for more mud-based fun for you. Maybe mud wrestling. I'm not sure. We're going to have to find a list of listeners. That's your homework. If you've got new mud-based adventures for Jake to go on, please hit us up. We would love to hear from you.
There you go. And with that, this has been No Cap Room on the Ball Don't Lie podcast network from Yahoo Sports. Special thanks to our producer, John Gennaro, and all the lovely people working behind the scenes, like Brett Rader sitting across from me right now. Evan Doherty, I saw you on a video chat that Brett was doing earlier. Follow us on Twitter as long as it continues to exist. I currently have no plans to get a blue verified check. I mean, like the Twitter blue one. Maybe we talk about that next time.
Maybe not.
But for now, I'm at Jake L. Fisher. That ain't changing regardless of the check. At Your Man Divine, he's there. If you've made it this far, please subscribe on whatever platform you're listening on and leave us a 5-star review. That would be great and super appreciated. The next show you'll hear on this feed is Good Word with Goodwill from our guy Vince Goodwill. He'll have on a brilliant guest, like always. His first two episodes had Bomani Jones and the great Howard Beck, so back listen to those if you haven't. This has been a great second show for us. We'll be back next Thursday as well. We appreciate you listening, and we'd appreciate it if you came back for that next episode of No Cap Room.